Our last case this morning is 2020-658, 2020-991, the State of Ohio versus Marshall Williams for the appellate. Mr. McCallum.
Good morning, Your Honors. Chief Justice, may it please the court. My name is Robert McCallum, and I represent the appellant, Mr. Marshall Williams, on behalf of the Cuyahoga County Public Defender's Office. With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal. There is no reason to expect an ordinary criminal defendant to know on his own that it is very dangerous and potentially unethical for one attorney to represent two people in the same criminal case. I imagine that many lawyers didn't even learn this until law school, or perhaps even after, and yet the practice continues to occur with some frequency. However, this case offers a simple and clear means of ensuring that everyone is aware of the rights and risks that are involved, and of doing what you have already said trial courts must do. So we know that a possible conflict of interest is, quote, inherent in almost all instances of joint or multiple representation. This court said that in State versus Dillon. And we also know that a trial court already is required to inquire whenever it knows or reasonably should know that a conflict of interest exists, or a potential conflict of interest exists, I should say. So what this case would do is essentially close the circle that was started in Gillard and Dillon and other cases, both from this court and from the United States Supreme Court, by explicitly requiring judicial inquiry whenever dual representation of co-defendants in the same criminal case is occurring.
In the trial court, there was never a request for that kind of instruction, right? The defense counsel represented both of them, husband and wife, right?
That's correct.
Okay. And all along, there was a joint plea deal that was pursued, correct?
That is also correct.
Okay. And my understanding is the way it turned out is that the husband did time or was sentenced, and the wife avoided jail and was put on probation. Is that correct?
That is also correct. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So I guess I'm trying to figure out how the judge would have viewed this as, you know, they're negotiating a package. Nobody is pointing fingers at each other. How would the judge have viewed that or known to view that as a conflict?
Well, so I think that the fact that it's a package is actually part of the problem. A possible conflict of interest, first of all, that's all that is needed to initiate the inquiry, is a possible conflict of interest. And so a possible conflict of interest can occur anytime that the defendant's interests might diverge. And so just the mere fact that they were being represented by the same attorney, I think right there, you have a possible conflict of interest, but then the package plea deal.
Counsel, what's the factual basis against the wife in the first place in this case?
Well, I was not her counsel at trial, nor on appeal, but I will say it was the marital home that was searched and that where drugs were allegedly found. So Mr. Williams, my client.
What we're looking at as maybe a good deal for her may not have been. If she had her own zealous attorney representing her, she may have had the charges dismissed. Is that correct? Altogether?
That is correct. That is correct as to her. And I think it's also potentially correct as to Mr. Williams. This from some perspectives might look like a good deal for one or both defendants if you just assume that they're guilty. But you know, given the problems in this case, I'm not sure that that's a safe assumption to make. And so one of those problems is this joint plea deal, where the trial court is not only.
But Mr. McKay, let me interrupt you for. But I do understand what you're saying, and there is the potential here for unequal representation or conflict. But the trial court judge has a lot going on. And if neither party, and we do have cases where both the defendant has raised a possible conflict and the state has raised it, if no one raises it, if no one complains about it, and if there is nothing that indicates to the trial court judge that there may be a problem with a conflict, what authority is there for I think what you want us to do, which is to say, anytime one lawyer represents co-defendants, the trial court should automatically inquire about a potential conflict.
Yeah, and that is exactly what I'm saying, Your Honor. And I think the reason is that, so first of all, I think that if the trial court is waiting to initiate an inquiry until it knows that there is an actual conflict,
or if someone brings to the court's attention that there could be anything about it, doesn't even have to say it has to exist, but anybody raises the iota that there might be a conflict.
Mr. Kaler?
It's certainly helpful if someone raises that. I mean, that makes it, you know, essentially unmistakable at that point. That kind of puts it in a, you know, it's whether the trial court knows or should know. And so if someone raises it, that kind of puts it into the no category.
Can that kind of conflict ever be waived by a client?
I think it depends. I think it depends on the facts of the particular conflict. I think that there are certainly situations where it could be waived. But I think that raises the important point that it should be waived, affirmatively waived, because of what's being risked here, the different treatment. And this sort of thing can sort of sneak up on you. It's not always, extremely obvious that this defendant wants to testify against that one and the other vice versa. Sometimes the conflict sort of matures and materializes and becomes more serious over time. And so, you know, I think it depends on the facts of the case. Some conflicts can be waived, some, depending on what's happening, probably can't. And ultimately, the rules of professional conduct kind of serve as a backstop here. But I think what this case is kind of standing for is that there would be a sort of two-step process where the trial court is first engaging in this inquiry to make sure that that the co-defendants are aware that they have the right to independent counsel, just as the trial court has to make sure that the defendants are aware that they have the right to counsel at all.
But some of the issues that arise are that the counsel may be refraining from zealous advocacy, or I don't even need to use the word zealous, for one, because of how it might overshadow some kind of defense of the other. So is that kind of conflict really waivable by a client?
Can we
find that it is?
I would be very skeptical that would be kind of, I think, one of the ones that's more sort of obvious or just apparent on its face from the nature of the conflict is probably difficult to waive. But that's exactly the sort of thing that is risked by this sort of situation. And the trial court might not necessarily know exactly what the conflict or even the possible conflict is beyond the fact that it is inherent in almost all instances of joint or multiple representation, but it will at least know that is true, that is just sort of true, particularly if this court holds that it is true as a legal matter. I don't think that it would be an adequate solution to require a defendant himself to object. First of all, it isn't required because we know that a trial court can be obligated to make the inquiry because it merely should know. And so presumably if it should know, no one has objected. And so we see United States Supreme Court cases like Sullivan where that happens. and where that rule is first established. And then even in this court's decision in State versus Dillon, that's kind of that case involves an objection and then the nature of how that objection should be levied. But this is really more of a no should know case. That's just because the trial court presumably knows, and at the very least should know, that the parties appearing before it are being represented by the same attorney, then that raises that duty merely to inquire. The government, in its brief, and I anticipate it'll argue today, says that, you know, first of all, there's no problem here. There wasn't a problem that the court could or should have seen. But even if there was a problem, the appropriate remedy is remanding to have that hearing, to have the inquiry into the possible conflict of interest. So I agree with the government, and I disagree with the government. I agree that an appropriate remedy would be to hold a hearing or to conduct the inquiry on remand. And that's exactly what this court directed to occur in Gillard, specifically in Gillard 2, and then kind of reaffirmed that in Gillard 3.
Mr. McCaleb, let's say we agreed with you and we remanded and told the trial court that it had to conduct the inquiry. What happens if the trial court says, you know, we should have had two counsel, not just one? What does the trial court have the authority or the jurisdiction to do at that point once there's been a final sentence imposed in the case?
So I think at that point, the appropriate remedy, if the trial court determines that there was a conflict of interest or that there should have been separate counsel, the appropriate remedy would probably be to vacate the plea at that point. And then essentially, you know, restart the case. This sort of complication, I think, is why the easier or the quicker this is done in future cases, the more smoothly it will go.
Well, can the trial court vacate the plea without somebody having to file a motion to withdraw the guilty plea then?
Well, I think so. Sort of relatively, new field of litigation. I think probably what would happen, and I guess I'm not certain that this is how it would unfold, is that we would have the hearing. I assume my office would represent Mr. Williams. If there was a determination that there was an actual conflict of interest, then we would then move to vacate the plea as having not been knowingly or intelligently made, because it was made with the assistance of actually conflicted counsel. But at this point, we just don't know. There's a lot to be suspicious about in this case, to be sure. But at this stage, the government questions the fact that Mr. Williams hasn't shown prejudice. And although I think that there could certainly be made a showing of prejudice here, and it's certainly easy to imagine what the prejudice would be.
Doesn't the prejudice go to a fundamental right?
So here the prejudice would only need to be shown if we were actually at this stage saying that there was an actual conflict of interest and that it did prejudice the defense. At this point, the prejudice is essentially that there was a possible conflict of interest and an inquiry wasn't had. And that has been the sort of level of inquiry that this court has engaged in previous cases and that the Supreme Court has engaged in, going all the way back to Holloway in like the 1970s, where the court said, well, say.
Doesn't that go to a fundamental right? I mean, if you find there's prejudice, what's the prejudice?
So I think if the trial court finds that Mr. Williams was prejudiced, I mean, it implicates like almost all of the rights that a criminal defendant has potentially. Certainly the right to counsel, certainly the right to due process, things that this court and the Supreme Court of the United States have both referred to as the most fundamental Fifth and Sixth Amendment rights, that assistance of counsel aspect. But you can imagine that
counsel, you're requesting then that we not make a determination on whether there was a conflict or not. We send it back to the trial court to determine that, the same court that heard it.
Yes.
Okay, all right. That's yes or no. And then what do you do with the the Manross standard, I guess. The court had a duty to investigate the potential conflict. And if there was no duty, the appellate court must determine whether an actual conflict occurred that adversely affected the ability. So are you saying just by looking at the fact they're a husband and wife and they're charged, that's a conflict?
So it, not that they're just husband and wife, but that they are co-defendants and that they're co-defendants. That alone, I think, is sufficient to create a possible conflict of interest. But in this case, it's that they're engaged in a package plea deal, that they are being represented in this case by an attorney who has since resigned his license in the face of a veritable mountain of ethics complaints and some findings. And that was likely known to the trial court since that was all going, I mean, it was big news in Cuyahoga County. And so all of that is sort of happening at once in this case. So it goes even beyond just the language in Manross or in Dillon into this territory where there are a heap of problems. And I think that's sufficient, certainly sufficient altogether to create this, to make the trial court know that there was a possible conflict of interest. And because the trial court knew, or at least should have known that, and didn't have a hearing, we would request, and I think on this we agree with the government, that there be a remand for a hearing on the question of whether a possible conflict of interest.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Zell, Lieutenant Carr.
Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court. My name is Frank Zelesnikar. I'm an assistant prosecuting attorney for Cuyahoga County, and I'll be representing the state of Ohio in this matter. Your Honors, the sole question before this court is whether a trial court is always required to inquire of co-defendants when they are represented by the same counsel, even if neither defendant objects to the joint representation at the time of trial. This court in State versus Manross has already answered that question in the negative. The United States Supreme Court and this court have both recognized that multiple representation does not violate a defendant's right to effective assistance of counsel unless it gives rise to a conflict of interest.
Let me ask you, what would be the harm in the trial court inquiry? It would be a matter of seconds. It could ward off potential problems down the road. It gives criminal defendants, make sure that they understand that they do have the right to separate counsel, or if there's been a discussion about potential conflicts. What's the problem with that? Why isn't that a good practice?
Well, I think in State versus Manross and in Kyler versus Sullivan, both those courts have stated that probably would be best practice. But the question isn't whether or not it's best practice. It's whether or not it is constitutionally required. And at the appellate level, where the defendant at the time of trial didn't object to this, there was no indication of a particular conflict. Should we be remanding it when the
why can't there be a constitutional requirement? Why isn't it a constitutional requirement that a criminal defendant understand what sort of representation he or she is entitled to?
Well, the constitutional requirement as it stands, as decided in Kyler versus Sullivan and in State versus Manross and State versus Gillard, is the fact that it's whether or not you're entitled to effective assistance of counsel. And effective assistance of counsel means assistance of counsel that is not marred by a conflict of interest. And in this case, you first have to show that there was an actual conflict of interest. Now, whether or not there's a constitutional mandate, this court has decided that, but if this court wanted to, it clearly has the ability to read that into the Ohio Constitution, as the Ohio Constitution is a document of independent force. But in all of the jurisdictions that the defense counsel cited to in his brief, every one of these jurisdictions, the federal courts, the Kentucky, West Virginia, all of those have adopted this rule that he's proposing, this mandate that the courts make this inquiry when it sees joint representation It does, has done it by rule, by criminal rule. For example, if you look at Kyler versus Sullivan, which is the, probably the lead case, the United States Supreme Court case in this area.
Is it the position that, so are you saying the state really isn't opposed to this? The state is just opposed to it being found or being required under the Constitution?
Well, I'm opposed to it being found as a constitutional mandate, as I haven't seen any court, any states, and I could be wrong, there could be some out there that have found this as a constitutional mandate. And the Supreme Court, this court has generally mirrored.
So are you opposed on principle?
I'm not opposed to a criminal rule that addresses the issue of what a trial court's responsibility is concerning joint representation. No, I mean, clearly the trial courts could benefit from a rule in the criminal rules to tell them what to do when they're in this situation.
Well, counsel,
whether or not it should be.
Counsel, the 8th District's language, and I find this a little disturbing, the attorney representing multiple defendants is in the best position to determine whether a conflict of interest exists or might develop. And then that is the reasonable for it. And that is reasonable for a trial court to assume that there's no conflict and the defendant knowingly accepts the risk of conflict or that. Okay, so if we're leaving it up, you know, by that to the attorney who's actually maybe being hired, receiving a higher fee, possibly influenced by the welfare of one defendant over another for various reasons. So when you're saying you want to leave that up to the attorney to make that call, is that really what we want?
Well, I mean, I think the 8th District in that case, in their opinion, was parroting the decisions in, I think, Kyler versus Sullivan and the Ohio Supreme Court. I believe the Ohio Supreme Court said the same thing in Manross, where the attorney is in the best position to determine.
Yeah, I know they're saying that. I'm saying, you know, we have this before us. This is our opportunity to take a look at that statement and say, is that really true? Is that something we want to, you know, be bound by?
No, and I agree with you. And I don't think they are they are obviously in the best position out of all the parties involved. The attorney and their clients are in the best position to determine whether or not there's a conflict, whether or not they're willing to accept it. However, this court, it doesn't mean the trial court doesn't.
Counsel, can't you fathom a time where there's co-defendants and one is totally oblivious to the fact that there's a conflict here?
Yes, Your Honor. And this is why, again, what I was going to say was the trial court, it doesn't mean the trial court it's solely left up to the trial court. Like again, in Kyler versus Sullivan and in Manross and in Gillard, the trial court's duty to inquire is when the trial court knows or reasonably should know that a conflict exists.
Let me touch on that, counsel.
So counsel, what about the prosecutor's role here? I mean, obviously, you know, the prosecutor's, you know, seasoned enough to realize mm-hmm. That there may very well be a conflict and they know what's happening. They know they can see it. What's the duty of the prosecutor?
Generally, it's from my understanding and usually like the practice in my office is obviously when we see conflicts or something that looks like a particular conflict, we will bring it up to the trial court to make the trial court aware of it, because clearly we don't want a conflict to arise later
down
the road. So if we notice a conflict, we'll bring it to the attention of the trial court.
Well, counsel, let me ask you this. Isn't the conflict obvious in a criminal case when a defendant is representing two people with various different theories of guilt on each one of them? Doesn't that give the prosecutor the opportunity in your plea negotiations to use one defendant as leverage over the others? I will give you this, but the other defendant has to plead to this.
Well, this is exactly sort of the same argument that the defendants in State versus Manross made. In State versus Manross, we had a situation very similar to the case here. In State versus Manross, you had a mother and a son where the son was selling drugs out of their home. The son was charged with 9 counts of trafficking and things of that nature. And the defendant, the other defendant, the mother, was charged with just 1 count. And they had different, obviously, theories of liability and things like that. And on appeal to this court, after they got convicted and after a trial, on appeal to this court, they made that exact same argument. And reading from this, the court's decision, the court specifically stated when they made that argument that the differing degrees of proof against the co-defendants are in and of themselves insufficient to establish an actual conflict of interest. At best, they're a basis for speculation. Now,
Mr. Zaleski,
no one's,
at some point, do you agree that there are some conflicts involved with joint representation that cannot be waived by the clients?
Yeah, of course. There are some conflict where they have just completely differing degrees of defense. For example, and I think one of the justices brought it up, is when someone is literally pointing the finger at their co-defendant. In that situation, I don't see how you can waive that, and I don't see why anyone would want to waive that sort of situation. But in this case, we don't have that at all. And I don't think the defense...
So if we were to draft a rule, how do we tell attorneys and courts when it can go forward and when it can't? I mean, how do we differentiate that? Aren't there a myriad of different situations that we would have to anticipate?
Well, sure. And I think there are multiple criminal rules throughout the country that we could take guidance from, you know, criminal rules that do require trial courts to promptly inquire. And I think the most telling part of all these rules, and it's particularly in the jurisdictions that Mr. McCaleb cites in his briefs, is that even in situations where the trial court by rule is required to make this inquiry, and where the trial court fails to make the inquiry, and where the defendant failed to object at the time of trial, on appeal, that in and of itself is not going to be enough to mandate a reversal. On appeal, in all those jurisdictions, you still have to show some sort of actual conflict. And I believe in West Virginia, you have to show a likelihood of an actual conflict. So you still have to demonstrate on appeal that an actual conflict existed. And if you demonstrate that an actual conflict existed, or there could be an actual conflict, well, that's when we look at State versus Gillard. And in those situations where the trial court was required to make that inquiry, and there's evidence of an actual conflict, the remedy is to remand it back to the trial court to have an after-the-fact hearing to determine whether or not there was an actual conflict.
Well, wide variety of, 9 years opposed to community control, is that any evidence of a conflict?
Well, I mean, no, I don't think so, because the state, if you look at the plea agreement, the state never argued for a specific, nor was there a specific time as part of the plea agreement. The state at sentencing just stated, we'd like, you know, to sentence the defendant to prison, because under the count one that Mr. Williams pleaded guilty to, it was amended from a mandatory 11-year sentence to the possibility of any time, mandatory time between 3 and 11 years. The state at sentencing didn't argue for a specific sentence that was given by the trial court. And I don't think the defendant's sentence was also made part of the plea. So when it came to the court sentencing, that was just the court sentencing. I don't see how a conflict, I mean, I think in his brief, Mr. McCaleb makes an argument that they could have argued differently. That's purely speculative, but I don't think that the sentencing or the sentences that they both received are any indication of a conflict. Generally, to show a conflict, you have to show that there was a defense that one of the defendants couldn't use because it would require the defense attorney to violate the loyalty he has or the duty to the other co-defendant. And we haven't had that presented here. And in situations where the defendant does show that there was an actual conflict of interest, the defendant still has remedies. The defendant can still file, like, for example, if the defendant has evidence outside the record, they can file a petition for post-conviction relief claiming that their Sixth Amendment rights and their rights under the Ohio Constitution were violated based on ineffective assistance of counsel due to a conflict. That could be raised in a petition for post-conviction relief. Or if it's obvious from the record, they could raise it on direct appeal. But in this case, we haven't had any indication of an actual conflict. And if you look at State versus Manross case, it makes it clear, like, mere speculation is not going to be enough to raise to that level of an actual conflict. And again, if this court wants to draft a rule, the proper avenue, and I think I make this pretty clear in my brief, is to just adopt the, go the route of all the other jurisdictions that Mr. McCaleb cites to in his brief. Do this through the rulemaking process, not by finding a constitutional requirement where this court and the United States Supreme Court, and I don't know, I'm not aware of any other courts that have found a constitutional requirement of this type. As such, I would just ask this court to follow its past precedent and to affirm the decision of the 8th District Court of Appeals in this matter. If there's any other questions, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. McCaleb, you've used your time. You may take a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I'm sorry I disconnected earlier. I'm not sure what happened. So just a couple of very quick points. First of all, the potential conflict in a package plea deal comes from the attorney's motivation to help client B by getting client A to plead. And that motivation may come completely separate from the actual culpability of those, either defendant or the strength of the government's case. That's the possible conflict. And as to possible conflicts, the government says that the trial court needs to be apparent, or it needs to be obvious that an actual conflict exists. And that's simply not true in order to demand an inquiry into the existence of a possible conflict of interest. And that's what didn't happen here. There was no inquiry into the possible conflict of interest raised by the dual representation.
Well, counsel, where would you, when would you, I'm presuming you're ideally you'd like to have a judge make that inquiry anytime there are multiple defendants, two or more defendants represented by the same attorney, okay? Would you extend that to the same attorney's firm if the multiple attorneys, but they all belong to the same, you know, which is not uncommon, a group of, attorneys doing primarily criminal work. And I'm just, maybe don't answer that because it doesn't really matter. The other thing, at what juncture would you impose this on the trial court?
I will answer the question as to the whole firm. I think a firm is generally considered, you know, one sort of attorney in the abstract sense for most ethical purposes. I think it would apply to the entire firm. As to when, it should be as soon as possible after the trial court knows or should know which that dual representation is occurring, which I think in this situation would be no later than the first like true pretrial. It could be earlier at arraignment or something like that. It depends, but certainly by the first pretrial and almost certainly not very much later.
Okay. All right, thank you.
I have a question. Counsel, do we have to overrule Manross to reach your result?
You know, in a way, yes, but in a way, no. This court has been retreating from Manross, I think, for a long time. It's barely mentioned in Gillard or Dillon. And when you synthesize together Gillard and Dillon, as I think, as I'm suggesting that you should in this case, there's not really any way of reconciling what Gillard and Dillon say together with what Manross says. Then on top of all that, I think Manross is incorrect in leaving this to the attorney alone, given that the way conflicts of interest work, that there's a very high risk that they're going to hijack the very judgments needed to take advantage of what, you know, you could call the best position. I mean, not to get too philosophical, but being in the best position in this case, which I think means close to the facts, can also actually make you be in the worst position, because you can't use them because of the conflict you're facing. So I do think, this court hasn't really talked much about Manross in the times that it's made decisions in this area afterwards. But I think at this point, Manross either is no longer good law because of prior decisions, or that this court should say that it is.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. We'll take the matter under advisement and you will be notified of our decision. Marshall, will you please adjourn court?
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session of the Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio now stands adjourned.